And we'll read in chapter 31. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, See, I have called by name Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And I have filled him with the Spirit of God, in wisdom, and in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, to devise cunning works, to work in gold, and in silver, and in brass, and in cutting of stones, to set them, and in carving of timber, to work in all manner of workmanship. And I, behold, I have given with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. And in the hearts of all that are wise-hearted I have put wisdom, that they may make all that I have commanded thee, the tabernacle of the congregation, and the ark of the testimony, and the mercy seat that is thereupon, and all the furniture of the tabernacle, and the table, and his furniture, and the pure candlestick with all his furniture, and the altar of incense, and the altar of burnt offering with all his furniture, and the laver and his fruit, and the cloths of service, and the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments of his sons, to minister in the priest's office, and the anointing oil, and sweet incense for the holy place. According to all that I have commanded thee shall they do. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, Verily, my Sabbath ye shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am the Lord that doth sanctify you. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy unto you. Every one that defileth it shall surely be put to death. For whosoever doeth any work therein, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whosoever doeth any work in the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout the generations for a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. He gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communing with him upon Mount Sinai, 2 tables of testimony, tables of stone, written with the finger of God. What we wish to do this evening, beloved, is to look with you rather simply at this good chapter in the book of Exodus. All of us, I'm sure, are aware that the book of Exodus is the book of the pilgrim. It's that book in the Old Testament written by Moses, which records for us the history of the nation of Israel as they made their way from Egypt to Canaan. The first part of the book is taken up with their redemption from the land of bondage. And thereafter, from chapter 13 on, we have the story of their wilderness experience. Now we should find that when we come through to this particular chapter, that what Moses is drawing attention to is the fact that God wanted to live in the midst of his people. And to that end, he gave instructions. It was always his desire to dwell with man. Moses indicates that in the first book that he wrote, the book of Genesis. But he was thwarted from that. And we all know how man disgraced himself to the extent that God could not commune with him, nor could he have daily fellowship with him. But that never removed from the heart of God the desire to be among his people. So in the book of Exodus, we learn that during their pilgrim journey, God would be in the midst of them. And to that end, instructions were given for the building of a tabernacle. Now what we have been reading in the first 11 verses of this chapter would be the instructions given to Moses and the help that God assured that Moses would have by introducing to the work of building the tabernacle selected men. You would find in these 11 verses mention is going to be made of two in particular. But if we had to look at the chapter, we should find that there are principles that are outstanding before we deal with the first 11 verses this evening. The principles that are outstanding is that God is bringing before the nation two particular days. From verse 1 to verse 11, he's drawing attention to the days for working. And then from verse 12 to the end of the chapter, he's drawing attention to a day of rest. Sometimes people get mixed up a bit and they take the rest before the day of work is over. This was largely the complaint of Paul when he was writing to the Corinthians. They were sitting back on their ease rather than getting their sleeves rolled up and getting into the work and into the service of the Lord. And it's good for us to understand that the day in which we live in is a day for working. The day of rest will come. God has decreed that there remains yet a rest for the people of God. That is outlined for us in the fourth chapter of Hebrews. But what we have here is that God indicating that there is a day of rest which will be observed. Now, this is illustrated by the introduction into the chapter of the truth associated with the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day was long in existence before Israel was asked to celebrate and to observe it. The Sabbath day was the seventh day of creation, and we all know from the book of Genesis that that day is treated differently by Moses in the early chapters of Genesis than he does the other 6 days. When he's describing the work of the other 6 days, he always concludes by saying, and the evening and the morning were the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth day. But when he comes to the seventh, there is no mention of the evening and the morning. It's so obvious that God's primal intention was that there would be a day without an evening. And that day would be the seventh day. It would be the day of rest. To that end, in dispensation, God has been working. And there is a day coming which will have a morning without an evening. Now that is obvious from what we have here. The number 7 associated with the Sabbath day is very significant indeed. And if you look at the mentions by Moses of the number 7, you will find that that significance increases. I'm just going to mention one of them to you tonight, but you can think of others. You remember there was a man called Enoch, and he is described by Moses in a very special way. He was the 7th from Adam. And you will recall that the most significant thing about Enoch was that he had a day that had no evening. So that you see how God's purposes in grace have been working through. So finally he reaches the day of rest. And we look forward to that day of rest. That would have been an interesting study to look at the latter part of this chapter. But then we've got 30 minutes tonight and we want to look quickly at the first 11 verses of the chapter, for these verses would indicate to us our responsibility today, illustrated in the experience of Moses, of Bezalel, and Aholiab, those three that are mentioned in the first 11 verses. I believe that God is asking us to build. We sometimes sing with the children, we are building day by day. But what are we building? And how are we building? Those are questions we ought to ask ourselves from time to time. And what we have in these 11 verses would come through to us as divine principles. And divine principles are through truth. That is, you find them in the Old Testament, and you will find them in the New Testament. Those principles never vary. God is the same. So that divine principles that we're going to look at in these 11 verses, which held good in that far-off day, still hold good today. And we trust that the challenge that they bring to us tonight will indicate not only our privilege of being asked to help in a divine work to build, but our responsibility to that building. I want to point out to you on five occasions in these first 11 verses, we have the sovereignty of God stamped unerringly on these verses. If you look, for example, at verse 2, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, I have called. Verse 3, I have filled. Verse 6, I have given. Verse 6 again, I have put wisdom. I have commanded thee. Is this not indicating to us the sovereignty of God in the building? He not only has provided the pattern, he provides the workman. And he expects the workman to follow the pattern. And to that end, in these I have of these first 11 verses, there is stamped on them the great fact and truth that God is sovereign. My beloved brethren and sisters, in regard to the building of a local assembly, it would seem that in Corinth they were unaware of this balancing truth that God is sovereign. And they began with envy in their heart, but ultimately led to a bitterness of spirit to do what they wished. And in the doing of that, they were cutting across the sovereignty of God. They were envious of those with gift. They were jealous of those who were working full out with their gift. So that Paul has to take one particular chapter and deal with that very matter. And I refer to chapter 12 of his first letter to the Corinthians, where he is saying the eye cannot say to another member, and the other member cannot say to the other member this, that, or the next thing. It's in that chapter that God, through Paul, is saying to us, God has set the members. God has tempered the body together. It is the sovereignty of God that we're dealing with in the building. Why should it be? There is no institution in the whole of the world of any generation like a local assembly. It is divine in its origin. It is divinely supported. It has a divine pattern, and it is not a committee of men. Knowing that, beloved, we must look for divine principles to help us. So shall we look a wee bit closer now at chapter 31 and verse 2. Here is the Lord saying to Moses, see, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And Moses might have said,
Bezaleel? Bezaleel? Not the man that I would have picked. God said to Moses, I have called. And God makes no mistakes. You see, in the epistle to the Galatians, it is so abundantly clear in the first chapter that Paul goes out of his way to say, I was called by God. I was not appointed an apostle by a group of men. I was not seconded to a group by men. I was called of God. And he was a master builder. He was not of man or by man. As to his apostleship and as to his building into the New Testament, the truth about God's building. I labor this point this evening, beloved, because I feel that we need to emphasize these truths again and again. God is sovereign in his own assembly. I have called by name Bezaleel. I want you to notice it was a divine call. And you can think tonight of those scriptures in the New Testament that would come home to you as you go over the intention of God here. Remember what Paul said to the Ephesian elders at Miletus? Over whom the Holy Spirit hath made you elders. We haven't time to go through other scriptures in the New Testament which would indicate that the interest of God as shown here in the building of a tabernacle in the wilderness has not waned in our day. He's still interested. I have called by name Bezaleel. It was a very personal call and a very particular call. I look around this hall this evening and I see, and I'm glad to see, so many young people. It may be that you have for days been thinking of what God would have you to be, what God would have you to do. And in your exercise before the Lord, leave time. Make it available so that God can impress upon your spirit, indicate to you the gift that he has given to you, and go in to exploit that gift to the full. I have called by name Bezaleel. It wasn't only personally and particular, but it was a very pressing call. One man in that whole congregation of Israel was the Paul of the New Testament, and I refer to Moses. He seemed to have the pattern, and he alone had the pattern. What a heavy responsibility. But now that pattern was to be shown to a man called Bezaleel. And when Bezaleel called of God, would come forward to Moses to receive the pattern. One can understand the feeling that would exist between these two men. Moses hadn't selected him. God had selected Bezaleel. And Moses had to make plain to him the principles of God. What was this teaching in that day? What would it teach us today? My beloved, I believe this, that no one man has the monopoly of truth. And that oftentimes there is a better grasp of truth sitting before the platform than on the platform. And God in his kindness has spread his truth among his people. And now we see this being shared. Soon it would go further out from Bezaleel. And Aholiab, and the wise-hearted, and they would all get to know the pattern, that it was divine in its origin, and it was for a house for God to dwell in the midst of his people. And they would all share a responsibility that would be common to each of them.
more of that today. I have called by name Bezaleel. I believe that just as God repeated this in calling men for a special work, he does so today. I don't think that he has moved away one little bit from his original intention. I think of the illustration in that little church in North Galatia called Antioch, where in the book of Acts, a number of prophets and teachers present and the Holy Spirit moves in and he says, separate me two of them. No, he didn't say that. He says, separate me Barnabas and Saul. He names them. The choice was his. See, he said to Moses, I have called Bezaleel. Now we come to the second point, verse 3. Before Moses could object on either physical grounds, intellectual grounds, educational grounds, or workmanship of a skill that was difficult, before he could object to that, he would listen to what God would say. Moses, I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship. The skill that was necessary was not gained in the schools of men. The skills that were necessary were given by God himself. His man was trained in those skills, and he filled him not only with the particular skills that would technically suit his fingers, but he filled his heart and he filled his mind, so that with knowledge and understanding and with the deftness that would come from a divine operation, so Bezaleel would work. My beloved brethren and sisters, I believe this, that whom God calls, he fills. And we might raise doubts in our own minds about the capabilities. But if God has really, genuinely called, God will ensure the filling. I have filled him. This is a divine principle. I can remember looking over the history of Crawford Allison, and it was a thrill. A man who left school before he reached his 15th birthday. So he didn't have the privilege of having a higher education. But how did he finish? God called him. Some folks raised their eyebrows at the time of his call, wondered if he was doing the right thing. How did he finish? He was proficient in not only two or three languages, he was proficient in seven languages. And was used as the official translator to translate into those languages. Why? Because God called him. And God filled him. And God enabled him. I have filled him. And one could recite other current examples of this precious truth. I'm saying that tonight for the encouragement of younger men and women who feel the call of God, but feel at the same time their own inadequacy. Whom God calls, God fills. And his Spirit is not given by measure. And then thirdly, let us look down until we come to verse 6.
And I, behold, I have given with him Aholiab.
Aholiab was from the tribe of Dan. And you will recall that in the march of Israel from Egypt to Canaan, Judah was away at the front, and Dan was away at the back. And as those tribes marched through, there would be seldom an occasion when the men of Judah would meet with the men of Dan for any length of time. I know that there were occasions when the whole nation came together, but there were thousands and thousands of them. Bezalel was living in the tents of Judah, Aholiab in the tents of Dan. What am I getting at?
I want to say to you that just as Moses didn't have the choice of Bezalel, Bezalel didn't have the choice of Aholiab. God was choosing the worker. And in all probability, unknown to each other. What did it teach us, my brethren? For men who are building for God, and who have the pattern of the New Testament scriptures on their heart, they will make it a matter of urgency to cultivate the ability to work with others. Isn't it good to read your New Testament and find that Paul was willing to join himself with Barnabas? Paul was willing to join himself with Silas. Paul was willing to join himself with Timothy. Paul with Titus. And we shall be, during this week, talking about other people who were work fellows and fellow workmen with Paul. Bezalel and Aholiab had to work together. There was no room for personality clashes. Beloved, is it not so that today, in the ranks of many assemblies, personality clashes have destroyed the unity and the ongoing harmony of an assembly? Can we come back to the book? Can we listen to the principle? I have called Bezalel, and I have called Aholiab. And both these individuals, under the guidance of the Spirit of God, and with the pattern given to them by Moses, had to work together. It's not only good for Christians to live together, to dwell together. Psalm 133 comes to mind that illustrates that. But to work together is progress from simply living together. And to go on to work together is the high road to spiritual success. And they work together. And what Bezalel would find was, here's a man with the same type of gift as I have. My beloved, is it not so that from time to time you detect a spirit of competition? Or perhaps conceit? From those who have similar gifts? It should not be. And competition has no place in the things of God. And each man's gift, although similar, must be complementary in the work. Bezalel and Aholiab work together. I think that's lovely. Well, let's pass on. We find in verse 6, that it's not only working with one individual, but he's now got to work with a number of others. I have put wisdom. Where? among those that are wise hearted. And sixthly, I don't want to transgress the time, his final principle in verse 6 is a very significant one, that they may make all that I have commanded thee. Underline that little word, all, that they make all that I have commanded thee. Oftentimes those with gift want to deal with certain scriptures, and they conveniently leave the other scriptures to somebody else. But that's not the case here. They had to make all that I have commanded thee. The ministry was to be full. It was to be complete. There was nothing to be lacking. And it had to conform with the pattern that God had given to Moses. Make all that I have commanded thee. It would seem that in this statement, there is something else, and it's this. That when God gave the commandment, God was going to give the enlightenment, so that what he commanded would be fully appreciated, and that all that he commanded would be able to be put into such practice that the tabernacle would be reared, and reared to his glory. Now let me say this to you. Let's come to a New Testament comment on this. Here is Moses. What's his position? Oh, he got the pattern. All right. Hebrews chapter 3 tells us, when there is a comparison made and very few people have been compared with Christ, in most occasions it's a contrast. But in Hebrews 3, in regard to faithfulness in God's house, Moses was reckoned to be faithful in God's house. That is, in the relationship that he had with the pattern and with the commandments that God had given, Moses was true and faithful. Oh, for men and women like that today, who are willing to simply stay where the scripture has put them and remain there. According to all that I have commanded thee. So they were enlightened. It would seem, too, that they would feel the sense of pleasure and completeness, gratification, as Moses records Exodus 40. What happened in Exodus 40? We have the one of the many chapters in the books of Moses describing the commissioning of the tabernacle. The house that was being built to the pattern that Moses had by Bezalel, the Holiab, and the wise-hearted. And in Exodus chapter 40, when the building was complete, and when their labor was over, what happened? The glory of God descended. God's presence was felt. Because they had fulfilled their task. And God crowned it with the ultimate success of his own presence dwelling in their midst. The glory of the Lord descended upon it. Isn't it wonderful betimes, beloved, when in our little companies we meet with each other and we feel the tremendous sense of the presence of God. One feels that those experiences are too infrequent. It should be always. God intended it to be so. And the work that was put in by Bezalel and Aholiab and Moses and the wise hearted was recompensed by the glory of the Lord descending upon it. Can't you understand now why the beginning of the chapter is indicating a day of work? Can you see the complementary part of the latter part of the chapter indicating that when the work would be complete, there would be a day of rest, a day of keeping Sabbath. God intends to dwell with his people, and he wants us to know the rest of Sabbath now in a spiritual way. We will know it in a very literal way in a day to come, but today in our local gatherings, he would wish us to know his presence. How can we have it? Can I go over this very simply? First, there is a pattern. Despite what other people would say to you, God has a pattern for his people today. Secondly, God is interested in the pattern, and he provides sufficient gift and gives enabling power to those whom he calls. And if you have been called to develop a gift that he's given to you, please do it to the best of your ability. God has called to the end that one day he would dwell in the midst of his people. Could I say it again? I believe that today is the day to work. And I'm not speaking at the moment of being gospel-minded. I trust we are all gospel-minded. But I'm thinking tonight of our responsibility to our own company. God would wish us to build into the company so that he can dwell in our midst.